Day with Dr. K. I'm here to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. Folks, today is a bit somber. Today, I want to have a conversation that is a little bit more of a fireside chat than a normal radio show topic. Sometimes there are topics that make us laugh. Sometimes there are topics that get our blood boiling. And sometimes there are topics that just cause us to sit back for a moment, to think deeply about who we are, and to think about the world that we are living in, and what world are we leaving our children. Today is one of those type of days. We gotta talk about an issue that must be put on the table, one that demands our attention. I'm going to do that in the first hour. I want to have a fireside chat with you about some issues that we need to discuss. In the second hour, we're going to continue with our normal Wednesday schedule, which is our weekly wrap. We tend to meet every Wednesday. We open up the phone lines immediately, and we can put everything on the table, everything, anything you want, keeping in mind that we do have listeners that are under the age of 18 months, and we have listeners that are over the age of 85. So we like to have topics that everybody can participate in. We will have our weekly wrap today, and you can put a number of topics on the table. We can talk about the Iowa caucus. We could talk about what happened last night with the 7th Congressional District. We do have a winner, in a sense, because here in Baltimore City, because we're so heavily Democratic, whoever wins the primary actually technically sort of kind of wins the seat. And that's the way it's been. So with that in mind, then we are offering our congratulations to Kwesi Mfumeh, who, with his seniority, with his skill, with his ability, with his reach, with his impact, will most likely be heading back down to D.C. To do the work that he is accustomed to doing. What is interesting is the word is that when he gets down to D.C., he goes back with the seniority that he had when he left that office. So he'll go back down to move quickly into some positions of power, into some committees where he can really make a difference. We are excited that the people have spoken. And on the Democratic side, for Elijah Cummings' seat, it was Kwesi Mfumeh coming in second. And third, really close, was Dr. Maya Rockamore Cummings and State Senator Jill P. Carter. On the Republican side, it was Kimberly Klasick, who was by far outpacing all the other Republican nominees. If you remember Kimberly Klasick, she is the reporter, television correspondent, videographer who shot the videos in Congressman Cummings' district over in the 7th Congressional District. And she made some statements that led to Donald Trump retweeting it and adding his own commentary, which got us into this whole thing around having parts of Baltimore City being called rat-infested, the work that we went through last year trying to change yet another negative image of Baltimore City. So she was the person chosen on the Republican side. What I want to talk to you about this hour, and what I think is really a fireside chat, I want to talk to you about what type of world, what type of country, what kind of city are we leaving our children? Folks, today, Trayvon Martin should be somewhere celebrating his 25th birthday. He should have finished college. He should be on his way to flight school. He should be celebrating with his family and friends that he's 25 years old. Instead, Trayvon Martin was killed at the age of 17. Today would have been his 25th birthday. Trayvon Martin was an honor student with a 3.7 GPA. He was accepted into college on a full ride. He worked as a volunteer and had over 600 service hours. He was a devoted member of his church. He was a loving son. He was not guilty of any crime other than being a young black man walking around the community after going to a store to get Skittles and iced tea, wearing Skittles and wearing a hoodie and jeans. George Zimmerman, who was the self-proclaimed vigilante for the entire community, felt that Trayvon Martin posed a threat to the community. And though he was told when he called it in to stand down, to not engage, to not follow, George Zimmerman took it upon himself to police the entire gated community. And ultimately, he killed Trayvon Martin. Now, there are those of us that remember this moment and what it was like to realize fully and completely that our children are not safe in this country, that our children can be killed while walking down the street and no one's going to be held accountable. This is not the first time this has happened. We remember Emmett Till. We know what it means to raise black children in America. We know that. We understand that there are countless horror stories of young African-American, young men and young women going off to school, going off to the market, going off to the store, going off to the mall, going off to church, and they never make it there safely. We know that there are countless stories. There was something about this particular time in history. It could have been a number of things. It could have been the fact that we were engaging on social media. And so the event felt closer to us than it was. Maybe we had just gotten sick and tired, as Fannie Lou Hamer said, of being sick and tired. Maybe it was just one too many young black children getting killed for us to go forward without making a stand. Folks, there comes a moment, I think, when you gotta make a stand, when you have to say no more, when you have to set up your zone where you say that no matter what happens, this is the ground that I am going to stand. I am not going to move from this spot. It is similar to when the Civil Rights Movement activists said, we shall not be moved. It is similar to what the young children said, the Birmingham Children's Campaign, when it was, you arrest us today, you let us out, we'll be back tomorrow, and you will arrest us again, because we will work to overcome. It's akin to what Harriet Tubman said when she made that decision to free herself. And then she went a little bit farther and said, I'm going to go back and get some more folks free. That I can't be free until everybody I love is free. I can't be free until we're all free. I can't enjoy my freedom knowing that my people are enslaved. Sometimes you got to take a stand. Sometimes you have to say that this is too much to bear, and you gotta push back. And when Trayvon Martin was shot and killed by Community Watch member George Zimmerman in 2012 in Sanford, Florida, the world started to pay attention. Now, the marches didn't start in 2012, but people were aware about it. There were protests, there were discussions, there were debates and conversations about race relations, but it was not until 2013 when George Zimmerman, after being arrested for second-degree murder, when he claimed self-defense, understand, Trayvon Martin was armed with nothing more than a sidewalk. Come on, folks, he did not have a weapon. George Zimmerman stalked him, he terrified him, he attacked him, and then he killed him. A Florida jury found that George Zimmerman was not guilty. Please understand, not guilty does not mean innocent. They did not find him guilty. In 2013, and the world exploded. Trayvon Martin's family, by all accounts, was robbed of justice. That doesn't mean, though, that the death of Trayvon Martin was in vain. Like Mike Brown's death just a few years later, Trayvon Martin's death really served as a wake-up call for Black America. It woke us up. There were some of us who were sleeping, folks, some of us who were, you know, being soccer moms and baseball dads. We were taking our kids to AAU basketball games and plotting out what time we're going to get our Starbucks. We were hanging out listening to our talk radio and playing our jazz music, but we were not involved in hands-on activist work. We were sleeping. We had come to believe, and I'm talking to you Generation Xers out there, you know, raised by these boomers, we had come to believe that we could work ourselves out of racism. We could buy ourselves out of racism. If we just make enough money, then our kids don't have to deal with some of the things our parents dealt with. If we just stay respectable, then our kids won't have to deal with the things our parents do. If we keep our pants pulled up, we keep our skirts down at the right height, make sure our nails are polished, if we get our makeup on and we wear our perms, and we make sure that our kids will be okay because we're doing everything right. We are checking the box for what it means to be a respectable Black person in America. And we're going to do all the right things. And that way, our kids will not have to have any struggles going to school. Meanwhile, as we were believing in and holding up this false narrative, there was a storm of building, folks. Now, many people call this storm the White Lash. And it began building when Barack Obama was first inaugurated into office. There was a sense by some people in this country, people not of color, that a comeback was necessary and needed. The number of hate groups, the number of hate crimes all spiked when Barack Obama was inaugurated. Now, I'm not blaming Barack Obama. By no means am I doing that. I'm just saying there was a change that happened. And with Trayvon Martin and with Mike Brown, it really helped to morph the phrase Black Lives Matter into more than just a Facebook hashtag, into more than just, you know, armchair activism. It actually became an influential and important movement, so much so that many people were calling it the second civil rights movement, the modern civil rights movement. Black Lives Matter changed everything. Black Lives Matter was more than just a rallying cry. It became a stand. It became a moment. It became what many of us begin to believe was what we should have been saying all along and what we must continue to say and cry and sing and yell and demand for people to recognize and accept that Black lives matter. Now, there was a pushback to this where we begin to hear things like Blue Lives Matter, which is something that was pushed by police officers. We heard All Lives Matter, which is something that was pushed by people not of color. I often say that nobody said any other lives mattered until Black people had the audacity to say that Black lives matter. Understand, folks, we were not saying only Black lives matter. Put that word in front. We didn't say only Black lives matter. Instead, we were saying Black lives matter too, as in also, as in addition to. So just like every other life mattered in this country, so too did Black lives matter. It was a movement that refused to be quiet about the injustices that Black and Latino people had endured and were enduring, and if something wasn't done to interrupt it, would continue to endure in terms of systemic racism and police brutality. It began to encompass everything from what's happening with the lead in our school to why are our students sitting in schools that are crumbling in the infrastructure to the ways in which our communities are being underdeveloped to talking about food deserts. Black Lives Matter covered everything. And it went from all walks of life, from the streets to the courthouse to the political sector and arena. Black Lives Matter became a movement that lifted up black women as they began to stand in the gap. It lifted up black mommies. I mean, let's be clear, folks. It was Black Lives Matter that birthed the Black Mommy Activist. That's how I became the Black Mommy Activist. Because prior to Black Lives Matter, that's not what I was doing. When I was talking about, you know, being the soccer mom, that was me. I was the baseball and fencing mom. I was taking my kids to practice, not thinking about these issues because we had overcome. And as long as I worked hard, as long as I did everything right, as long as I checked the box and did my own type of menial activism, then my kids would be okay. My sons would be okay. My boys would be okay. Black Lives Matter helped me understand that they were not. Our children were not okay. And in addition to our children, guess what, folks? Eric Garner showed us that our husbands and our uncles and our brothers were not okay. And guess what? Sandra Bland showed us that our sisters and our mothers and our aunties were not okay. And then we begin to see grandmothers being harassed and killed. And then we realize that Nana wasn't safe. Nobody with black skin was safe. It's been 7 years, folks. Think about that. 7 years since this young man, his life sparked this movement. And I'm thinking, as well as a number of other writers and reporters are saying today, the Black Lives Matter message is needed more today than ever. Look at this, folks. We've talked about Freddie Gray, but have we resolved what led to that uprising? See, it's not just about Freddie Gray's family receiving compensation. They got that. It's not just about the fact that they didn't receive justice, because that happened too. But what happened with Freddie Gray? The tipping point was reached for us here in Baltimore City, for a number of communities that looked around and said, this is not enough. We deserve and will demand more. Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, Corinne Gaines, Tamir Rice, Rakia Boyd. Since we have been talking about Black Lives Matter almost every single week, and surely every single month, we've got news of a black person, a Hispanic person, falling victim to state and police brutality. It got so bad just a couple of months ago. Let's remember, it was almost weekly that we were talking about incidences where people not of color were calling the cops on black folks. We just stopped talking about that a couple weeks ago. I mean, come on, from Starbucks to Target to Walmart to Denny's to CVS, the relentless attacks, verbal, sometimes physical, definitely emotional, definitely spiritual, definitely mental attacks that black people have had to endure. And I'm not talking about since the beginning of time. I'm just talking about since Black Lives Matter. It seems like the movement has ended, but there was very little accomplished. Not just in terms of who got elected, but the fact that I am not sure if people are actually convinced and actually believe that black lives matter. Today, Trayvon Martin should be somewhere celebrating his 25th birthday. He should be. Today, black moms should be able to sleep through the night and have to think about violence and brutality against our children. Today, husbands and wives and partners and aunties and uncles and grandparents who are black folk and Hispanic folk should be able to walk comfortably through a store and not believe that they're going to have the cops called on them. Today, we should be able to talk about these race issues and not feel like we're opening up a can of worms into a conversation that might be too difficult for us, because no one will ever say, you know what? What I just said was racist. And so I need to deal with that, because I am not racist is the quickest thing to say. I am not racist is the immediate pushback to Black Lives Matter. When we come back, folks, we're opening up the phone lines. It's the weekly wrap. You can put whatever you want on the table. I just wanted to take a moment to, remember Trayvon Martin. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Stay with us. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, we are opening up the phone lines. It's the weekly wrap, so you can put whatever you would like on the table. We appreciate you just listening in and chiming into the conversation. So give us a call, 410-319-8888. I have Curtis on the phone. Curtis, how are you from Anne Arundel County?
Hello?
Hello, how are you?
Hello?
Hello, you're here.
Hello, Dr. K.
How you doing?
Hello?
All right, hold him on. Let's see if we
Hello?
Get that fixed. Hold him. Hello? Let's try to fix that. Let's go to Miss T, a new caller from Maryland. Miss T, how are you? Welcome to the family.
Hello. How you doing, Dr. Kim?
I'm doing well. Thank you for calling.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I was just calling because I have been trying to get some help with some employment issue I had.
Yes.
And I've called, like, legal aid, lawyer's referral. Yeah, attorney general, you know, the state's attorney's office, and I can't seem to get through to anyone, and, you know, just to get some answers or some insight as to how I should handle a situation, you know, with the employer, but I'm just kind of at a loss.
Well, then let me ask, so you are trying to get a job?
No, I have an employer that I'm having some difficulty with.
Okay.
And I need to have the correct advice. I've even tried contacting the HR department.
Okay.
And the HR department.
Okay.
To no avail, though.
Okay. So you tried the EEOC office, no answer. You tried your own HR office, no answer. Have you been documenting what's been happening?
Yeah, everything is pretty much documented.
Okay. Okay, because I'm trying to figure out, and I want to put this out to my listeners. Folks, we have someone who needs some assistance. She has contacted EEOC, can't seem to get an answer, can't seem to get an answer from her own HR department, but you're having an issue. Does the issue fall around race? Is it around class, around gender, or a little bit of all the above?
Well, it's kind of difficult to say. I mean,
okay.
It could be a little all the above.
Okay. Okay. And so are you still continuing to work with this person?
Yeah.
Okay. And the situation has not been discussed. All right. Hold on one second. What we're going to do, Ms. T, is that we're going to take your information, and I'm sure someone's going to call. Folks, we have a listener who needs some advice and some assistance. So if this is you, if you are involved in these type of situations, if you are a lawyer and can offer your advice, if you're someone who is in connection with the EEOC or you work in an HR department, to give her the best advice, to point her in the right direction, we would appreciate it. Hold on, Ms. T, let's get your information. All right, well, we're taking care of that. I'm gonna go to Melanie Price. Melanie is a political scientist, and to help us just kind of understand what exactly is taking place in Iowa, so we can wrap our heads around it. Melanie, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So just to kind of give people some background, we know that the Iowa caucus happened this week, and Iowa is the place for a lot of people, a lot of candidates. It's kind of it's where they either are going to decide they have what they need to go forward or they pull out before this caucus. I mean, we lost a lot of people. I'm thinking of Cory Booker and Kamala Harris. People said they didn't have enough money to continue or they weren't polling high enough. We've lost Julian Castro, incidentally. You know, those are three of the candidates of color. And we're at a point now.
We lost all the candidates of color.
Yeah, we lost all the candidates of color. At this point, it seems like we are, it's the same people in terms of, you know, being white, millionaires or billionaires in this sense, except for Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and we could talk about him. But Iowa had some issues. Can you explain first for my listeners, why is the Iowa caucus so important?
So the Iowa caucus is so important because it allows people who don't have a lot of money to be able to just drive around this one sort of not huge state talking to people directly. And so it gives candidates who might be promising but don't have a lot of money the chance to make themselves known to people. And if they win in Iowa, then they can use that as a way to get more people to donate money to their campaigns. So they need that momentum to be able to move forward.
Okay, so now with Kamala Harris, one of the reasons she came out, she said she did not have enough money to continue.
Right.
Was it to continue to even get to Iowa? Because we lost her early on.
Yeah, it's two things. It's not just that she didn't have enough money to continue, but it wasn't her path to winning wasn't as clear.
Okay.
Right? She assumed that black women would be one of her strongest supporters, and in the Democratic Party, black women are a key constituency. But when she wasn't able to sort of secure that support, then it also made her donors sort of more fearful about giving her more money, right? So those two things are tied together. So that is, she wasn't rising in the polling. African-American women weren't taking her up as their candidate of interest, and that made donors kind of antsy, and so they stopped giving her as much money. And all of those things sort of come together to, you know, make her have to leave the race.
Now, with Cory Booker, there was a bit of a surge that happened for him after the last debate when he was very clear saying, look, I'm the last candidate of color, and I need to stay in this. So it seemed like within 24 hours, there's an incredible surge to give money to him.
Yes.
But then he ended up dropping out.
Right. Well, first, let me say that Deval Patrick actually threw his hat in the ring, but
yes,
we haven't heard very much
not
from him. So technically, he's still in the race, the former governor of Massachusetts, who's African-American. But also, at the point that Cory Booker was doing that, he was already on his, that was sort of the gasps of a dying campaign.
Oh, okay.
And so, when you're asking people for money so you can continue, what that means is you've already cut staff, you've already had to cut your budget, you've already done all of these cost-saving mechanisms that's going to make it very difficult for you to gear back up again, right? So as soon as he started making these pushes, it actually was kind of clear that his campaign was coming to an end.
Oh, okay.
And because money is so important in this process, and it's particularly true for people of color who have to not just convince people that they're competent enough to be president, because we believe that they are, but also that for whites in these states, that it's actually worth it to vote for somebody outside of their race. And that's an incredibly difficult proposition.
So now, with that in mind, how did Julian Castro exit? Because I felt that maybe he was, because he seemed to have been running just a campaign alongside the main campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Every time they would have a debate, he would have something online, but it felt like it was just not enough.
There's no doubt that all of these candidates of color were really hurt by two things that were criteria for ending up on the debate stage. So they weren't able to poll high enough. Right. So they weren't getting enough support in the polls that were used to determine whether or not they would end up on the stage. And then also the party required that there were a certain amount of individual people you got to donate to your campaign.
Okay.
And those two things proved to be really difficult for candidates of color. Julian Castro, I think, has come out really the best out of all of this in terms of future prospects. And so I think this is not the last that we've heard of Julian Castro. I think he was just coming into his own stride when he was when he didn't make the cut for the debate stage. And so watching him, I think you'll see him come back again, if not in the next election, then in the coming presidential election. I think he's just getting started.
Okay, so then now that we have talked about who's not here, let's talk about what's going on now. Because I know there are a lot of people. Deval Patrick, for example, just got in. But if we could, I'd like to look at kind of the big five or six that everybody's been talking about. Warren, Klobuchar, Biden, Sanders, Buttigieg.
Right.
And I'm going to put in there, reluctantly, I'm going to put in Tom Steyer, who seems to be just, you know, I mean, Bloomberg is just spending, but just, So,
I mean, anybody who spends $200 million to make themselves a household name should be a household name.
Yeah.
So the fact that people are talking about Bloomberg is not surprising because he has spent a ton of money. I heard someone say that it's enough to give every American household $50.
Oh, that's just something. That's just, I mean, it's just painful when you think about it.
Right.
It is painful.
So Tom Steyer has spent probably $80 million. Maybe he might be at $100 million to come in like, I mean, I think he got 2% of the Iowa caucus of the votes that have been, of the results that have been reported. And so I wonder how long he'll actually stay in this, too, given that prospect.
You know, it's interesting. When you are, I'm just going to put this out. When you are a billionaire and you can just fund your own toys.
Then
you can do this kind of, because it doesn't impact you. I mean, if, you know, if you start talking about $1 billion, Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg, Andrew Yang, they can hang out for a long time if they want.
So Bloomberg has reportedly paid his campaign staff through November. They have guaranteed payment through November. He has advertisements running in nearly all the Super Tuesday states. He, you know, ran ads during the Super Bowl, which is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
And so the ability to do that puts you in a whole different category.
Right.
I mean, there are others who've done it in the past. I think about Steve Forbes, who ran in the Republican Party in the 80s and 90s. And so it's been done before, but it isn't normally a Democrat who's doing it. Normally, these kinds of self-funded campaigns have come more on the Republican side than the Democratic side. And so that part is really surprising. But hey, I mean, one of the things that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren can boast about is the amount of individual donors who fund their campaigns. And that says something about sort of level of support in a different way than a person who says, I'm going to use my money to do all of this.
Right.
First of all, if they're using their own money, they're not beholden to anyone but themselves.
Right. So they can do it that
not,
way. Yeah.
So it's actually undemocratic.
Yeah, I'm going to say the whole process of just doing your own thing and having that kind of money is undemocratic, but that's just me.
Oh, of course, right? It's very capitalist, but actually undemocratic.
Yeah.
Because what it basically means is you can push any idea you want, and as long as you can outspend every single other person, then your voice gets heard. And it seems like it's a popular voice, but it's not. It's really just driven by one person. But look, in Iowa, the thing that's really clear, the thing we know about Iowa and to a large extent New Hampshire, is that these are two states that nobody would be paying attention to except for the fact that they go first.
Right. And that's what's concerning, because people know that if, you know, in the past, whoever has won Iowa, in a sense, has typically gone on to be the nominee. And right now, it seems like it's Buttigieg.
Right.
Can you talk about that? I mean, I'm a little bit, I'm confused about how, I'm seeing numbers with Buttigieg and Sanders are 1% or, they just seem to be very close. Can you help us understand that?
Sure. I mean, it is true that lots of people who have won Iowa have gone on to be the nominee. But if you think back to 2016, there was essentially a statistical tie. And so Hillary and Bernie were about in the same place. She ended up getting more delegates than he did. But essentially, when you look at the results, they were about at a statistical tie. And so part of the problem is, part of the thing that's interesting about this is the ways in which we have placed so much on Iowa, when it's really just about people who have time on a Monday night in the middle of winter to leave their houses and go to public spaces and stand around and debate about candidates in a state that's 90% white.
Okay. So
and so when you think about it that way, then Iowa should matter much less.
It really should. Than
it actually does. And I actually wonder whether or not the party, the national party, might see the kind of consistent problems that Iowa has had over the last couple of presidential cycles and see this as a time to maybe reconsider it. I think Iowa themselves should just do a primary like everybody else. These caucuses are incumbent. It's difficult for people who are differently abled. It's difficult for older people because they don't want to come out at night. There's lots of things that are happening that make these caucuses sort of problematic. But that's not really what happened in Iowa. Iowa essentially tried to do something new. That is, they were going to tell you the whole process of deliberation. So they've always been keeping track of who is the first, who do you vote for on the first round? And then who do you vote for on the second round in this super complicated system? But this is the first time that they ever tried to give the public that data. And in that transparency and just bad decisions about technology, we end up with this mess that has happened so far, where basically if you didn't win, you can say, well, the results are suspect. Right. And if you did win, you can just say, essentially Monday night, every single one of them said they won.
Okay, because it's so messed up. All right, my last question. I just really appreciate you coming on, and we we cannot wait to have you on more so we can keep talking through this as we're making our way through. Mm-hmm. But here in Baltimore, yesterday, we had the 7th Congressional District race, special primary.
Yes.
And it got confusing for people, right?
Because, well, I should say it involved a college classmate, Maya Rocky Moore Cummings,
who went
to Prairie View with me when I was, she was in, at Prairie View when I was there.
Okay, mm-hmm. good. So you followed it. But mm-hmm. what is confusing for some of us is that, okay, so this is how I describe it, and so you can help me really be clear. I was like, well, mm-hmm. it seemed like they ran yesterday to finish up the term.
Right.
And then they got to run again in April
exactly.
to kind of continue with the term.
Right.
And then you
right.
got to run again in November if you want the term to be yours. That's what's
right.
confusing.
It's strange because one would think that, I don't know the rules in the state of Maryland, but there are other kinds of ways that this could have been done, potentially a person put in place by the governor. I don't know what the laws are there. So it really varies from state to state about what happens when a member of Congress or a senator dies. Often in many states, somebody just would have been designated as that person, and then they would only have to run once, which is running for the permanent seat. But all of this also begs the question of how will people be too fatigued by November to even be bothered with this? I think in a situation where you have a crowded field, then what's going to ring true is that people they feel like they know already are going to win.
Okay.
And then essentially, Kwesi Mfume ends up at the top because he is a familiar brand to people in Baltimore.
Okay.
And so it's understandable that he ends up at the top. But also you have a situation where you have the widow of the late Congressman Cummings running, but also his daughters endorse another candidate, right?
Very confusing.
And so it's not like there's a clear signal from the Cummings family themselves about what they think should happen to this scene.
Right.
And in that void, I think, steps familiar faces. And no one is more familiar to the people of that district than Kwesi Mfume, who was their representative for a very long time.
That's
and it would have been inappropriate for him to challenge Elijah Cummings, but it's not inappropriate for him to challenge all these other people. And so it's a way for him to get back into a job that they've seen him do lots of times.
That's actually a really good point, because in the mm-hmm. research I did, and just let me tell you, I'm not a political scientist,
mm-hmm.
but in the research I did, anytime the widow
mm-hmm.
has stepped into and gotten elected, it's mm-hmm. because the family all stood with the widow,
right.
that this
right.
is daddy's dream, this is Uncle Russ's dream, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. his wife continues
and
his work.
And it's very true that
right.
it's often how women came into politics.
Yes.
So some of the earliest women who held political office were women who were taking the place of husbands who had passed on or husbands who were incapacitated. The first female governor of the state of Texas, which is where I live, was a woman whose husband died. And so that's a way that people come into office. Sonny Bono, when he died, his wife right. took over. So there's lots of examples of that. But that is true because normally that family is sort of speaking with one voice.
And I think that is a thing that didn't help.
I think also Baltimore, like Houston, where I'm from, they recognize Native sons, right? And
right.
I think that to some extent, mm-hmm. you know, people were familiar with Maya Rocky Moore Cummings. They knew her because she ran the state party, but they wanted probably somebody who was
yeah.
from Baltimore.
Yeah.
And so getting somebody from Baltimore probably was very important to them. I mean, we'll still figure out sort of what happens in this process. I think, you know, all of us were sort of interested in seeing it, mostly because it's super huge shoes to fill.
Right, it is.
And we need someone
right.
who is going to push the politics that Elijah Cummings did. And so whoever can do that, I'm really happy for them to be in office. I would have loved to see Maya win because, you know, it's an alum. It's a person who would be good for my university. But also I think, you know, Kwesi Mfume is just somebody who is too familiar. At some point we can talk about how I think that Black people in general are making the same kind of calculation with Joe Biden.
Oh, that's very, and that is an.
It's actually
okay.
a smaller example of what they're doing with Joe Biden.
There we
He's
go.
Familiar.
Yep.
They know him. He's connected to somebody they love.
Yeah,
you know,
they love
all
Barack
the things
Obama.
That sort of represent all the reasons that people would vote for Kwesi Mfume. It's
right.
a known entity. It's the same thing, I think, for Black people and Joe Biden. But the thing, problem with that is if Joe Biden doesn't do well in New Hampshire, there's going to be more and more and more of a push for him to bow out because essentially him and Mayor Pete are sort of going for the same voters.
And which is, okay, so now this is actually my last question because I
okay.
cannot let that go. Because uh-huh. Mayor Pete, who is Mayor Pete from South Bend,
yeah.
Indiana, which is where I went to graduate
mm-hmm.
school, University of Notre Dame, he
right.
is he's white, he's male. In those ways, his military
he's never gotten
service,
more than 10,000 votes.
Right. But I mean, but if you just use white, male, military, upper middle class, on paper,
mm-hmm.
he
mm-hmm.
checks all the boxes. But then you have
right.
this other piece as being same-sex preference and married to a man.
Right.
And even with that, here he is. In places where you would think it's conservative, he's floating high in like a place like Iowa, but he's polling
right.
at 0% in the Black community.
Right. And there's no way he's actually going to look. There's no way that you can win the presidency as a Democrat without African-American support.
Yeah.
And so it's highly possible. It could be that he wins Iowa and wins New Hampshire and then gets clobbered in South Carolina.
Oh, yes.
But whoever wins South Carolina, then that gives them a big push.
Yeah.
So what I'm guessing is Joe Biden is just trying to hold on for
South Carolina
so he can say, but look at what happened here.
Yeah.
I have African-American vote. I mean, he's very cocky about it. He says it
he
all
did.
The time.
He said they love
about
me.
How he's the candidate.
Yeah.
You know, he has twice the Black support than most other candidates. I think in the end, Black people are going to get behind whoever is a Democratic nominee. I know for a fact that African Americans are exhausted by the Trump White House.
Right.
They are afraid about the prospects of what four more years of him means. They've been on high stress and high alert for the last 3 years.
Yes.
And so whoever the Democrats put forward, I think Black people are going to vote for. The question is how much enthusiasm they'll have about
right.
that vote, right?
Well,
whether
hold
or
their
not
nose
people,
and pull
who,
their, yeah.
people who normally wouldn't people who would, you know, they kind of take or leave voting, will they come out of their house for Pete Buttigieg? And I think part of that is about questions about homophobia. But I think more than that, before they can ever get to homophobia, Pete Buttigieg is just someone who is so unfamiliar to them.
Yeah.
I think he seems too young for most African Americans. I think there are lots of things about him that suggest that any African-American of that same age, which that little experience, there's no way they would ever be able to have this high a platform.
Yeah. It's interesting because with Barack Obama, who was young, who was
yes.
unfamiliar, but the number of Black folks, including our very
mm-hmm.
own Elijah Cummings, who
right.
leaned in for Barack Obama and said,
right.
you may not know him, but
mm-hmm.
we do.
Trust us, we got him. I think are really important. The first is Barack Obama had won a statewide election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Buttigieg won the mayor of South Bend.
Which
by
is
like
a very
9,
small place,
votes.
By the way. You can walk
through
South Bend
very
in like 10 minutes.
Different. Barack Obama had already got millions of votes and had already spent
mm-hmm.
time in the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't as experienced as many people wanted him to be, but he had way more experience than Pete, Pete Buttigieg. I'm sorry, I forgot my second point. I don't remember what it is.
But you know, let me say this. I'll add this because I think what's interesting is that there's a lot of talk. I've read a lot of articles about the number of black folks who went into South Carolina.
Right.
And talk to black people in South Carolina to help them. Hey, you got to come over from the Hillary camp. Come on over here to Barack Obama.
Oh, now I remember. Thank you. That's very helpful. You're good at this. So the other thing I was going to say is if you looked at 2008, one of the things that we know is that African-American, the CBC, at this point in the race, they were primarily for Hillary Clinton. We like to think about this as a moment where the Congressional Black Caucus got behind Barack Obama immediately, and they did not.
Nope.
And so it took them a minute. It took African Americans voting and saying they wanted Barack Obama. I remember John Lewis saying when his district went heavily for Barack Obama that he has to go with the will of his people. It's not like they were, initially on board for Barack Obama. It took them a minute to come around to him. And I think it can take a minute for black people to come around to another candidate when Joe Biden is out of the race. My question is, will it be a candidate who they feel any affinity at all with, or will it be somebody who they have soundly rejected, like Pete Buttigieg?
All right. Thank you so much, Melanie Price. Mm-hmm. We will be checking in with you again. You're our new resident political scientist because we always have so many questions, and it's just great to just have someone help us make sense of it. So we appreciate
you. Talking about politics is my job, and it's one of my favorite pastimes.
Yeah, we'll have you back on as we figure some things out. We'll be talking to you, Melanie Price,
right,
folks. Thank you so much. So, folks, we're going to continue with our open phones. It's the Weekly Wrap. Give us a call. Put whatever you want on the table. I have Lawrence on the phone from Baltimore. Lawrence is going to connect with Miss T, but he also wanted to put something on the table. Lawrence, how are you? It's line 5. All right, Lawrence, you hold on 1 second. I'm going to go to Lou. Lou's a new caller from downtown Baltimore. Lou, how are you? Welcome to the family. All right. I think there is something that's going on with the phones, but we will figure it out. And so, folks, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break in just a second. When we come back in the next hour, we've got somebody who wants to talk about Bob Marley because his birthday is tomorrow, February 6th. We want to talk about what is happening in politics. I mean, do you actually think that black folks would get behind anyone other than Biden? But be clear. Do you think black folks will get behind Bernie Sanders? I'm thinking Bernie Sanders is not going to be a problem. Will they get behind, Elizabeth Warren? Probably Elizabeth Warren is doing a whole push through HBCUs right now. Would they get behind Mayor Pete? Would they get behind a Tom Steyer? Come on now, folks. It's going to be interesting when we talk about this and think about this, because you can't win the Democratic nomination, the nominee, if you don't have black folks behind you. You can't do it. And so we got to talk about that. It's Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise-Y. Do we have time for one more phone call? One more. We'll go straight to Lawrence from Baltimore. Lawrence, how are you? Okay, so what we'll do instead, we're going to take a quick break. I'm laying on my face right now. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get the phones figured out. We'll play some K-Opley, and I'll hear from you when we return.
And a good afternoon. The light rail link is experiencing a delay of about 25 to 30 minutes in both directions. No such delays on the Metro Subway link. On the MART train system, all trains on the Camden and Penn lines running from Washington through Baltimore are running on schedule. Local link bus diversions include 83 northbound diverting at Reisterstown Road and Old Court. The Gold Line diverts westbound at Washington and Pratt Street. The 71 and 73 lines diverting northbound at Hollins Ferry and Patapsco. 71 and 73 southbound diverting at Waterview and Hollins Ferry. For the MTA Transit Team, I'm Ken Berger on 88.9 FM WEAA, the voice of the community.